These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, a conversation with veteran activist and political theorist, Omali Yashitela, chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. Africa World Now Project is next. In Almachar Cabral and the Theory of the National Liberation Struggle, Professor Ngozola Ntalaja writes that Almachar Cabral's contribution to understanding the success and failures of liberation movements resides in his demonstration that national liberation struggles have two phases, the national phase and the social phase, with the latter being more critical to its ultimate conclusion. Each phase is specific with regard to the historical task to be accomplished and to the class alliances and organizational structures necessary for carrying them out successfully. Whereas the national phase involves principally the struggle for national sovereignty or independence, the social phase is one in which the very question of genuine liberation is clearly posed. Has independence benefited the gross majority of the population economically and socially? This analysis is, of course, theorized within the reality that nation-states themselves have deep inherent structural implications that will come into contact with communities of people that are excluded from its fundamental assumptions of how and for whom society should be organized. It is also based on the reality that nation-states, as advanced through European projects, were themselves developed as a direct product of imperialism and as attendant forms of colonialism, direct, indirect, neo, settler, and internal. According to Amiri Baraka in Towards Ideological Clarity, the 18th century, a time when European nation states, driven by old wars between tribal Europe, began to solidify their existence as national entities, was also the time when European capitalism amassed the initial wealth it needed to bring about the unprecedented technological advances responsible for what was later called the Industrial Revolution. This primitive accumulation cannot be separated from the European slave trade, as Walter Rodney calls it, or as properly understood as international human trafficking, which allowed the European nation-state to forge ahead of the world in all spheres, but at the expense of the African people. Writing in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, Walter Rodney further argues that throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, and for most of the 19th, the exploitation of Africa and African labor continued to be a source for the accumulation of capital to be reinvested in Western Europe. The African contribution to European capitalist growth extended over such vital sectors as shipping, insurance, the formation of international corporations such as, but not limited to, the African Royal Company, the East India Company, capitalist agriculture, technology, the manufacturing of machines. The most spectacular feature in Europe, which was connected to the African trade, was the rise of seaport towns, most notably Bristol, Liverpool, Bordeaux, and Seville, to name a few. Directly or indirectly connected to those ports, there often emerged the manufacturing centers which gave rise to the advancement in industrial production. In England, it was the county of Lancashire which was the first center of the Industrial Revolution, and the economic advance of Lancashire depended first of all on the growth of the port of Liverpool through the trade of human capital, enslaved Africans. The legacy of this is encapsulated in an African world left to wrestle with the contradictions inherent in socio-political and economic structures where the exploitation of human and natural resources is the foundational ethos and the human response is a reclamation of its humanity as developed from a critical consciousness. In the case of the African world, a critical Africana consciousness. Today, Africa World Now Project is in conversation with veteran activist and political theorist Omali Yashitela, chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. In 1966, Chairman Omali ripped down a racist mural from the walls of City Hall in St. Petersburg, Florida, and further developed a political and intellectual trajectory informed by anti-colonialist movements around the world and the struggle for liberation for people of African descent in the United States. Chairman O'Malley has dedicated his life to refining a praxis that seeks to institutionalize freedom for the African world, theorizing an African internationalism that understands the world through the perspective of the African working class. Chairman O'Malley's political philosophy has inspired generations of activists to understand the interdependence of the African world. In 1968, Chairman O'Malley founded the Burning Spear newspaper and has authored numerous books, pamphlets, and articles, including his latest book, An Uneasy Equilibrium: The African Revolution versus Parasitic Capitalism. In 1972, the African People's Socialist Party was formed along with the Worldwide Yahuwu Movement and the African Socialist International, with branches active in the United States, Europe, the Caribbean, and on the continent of Africa. In 1976, Chairman O'Malley formed the African People's Solidarity Committee, along with several mass organizations, including the International People's Democratic Yahuwu Movement, which for more than 20 years has been the forefront in defending the African community from police violence and other colonial attacks. Other organizations created by Chairman O'Malley include the All African People's Development and Empowerment Program, the African National Prison Organization, and the Black is Back Coalition. From this, a number of economic institutions were created, such as Sphere Graphics, Yahuwu Bakery in Oakland, Yahuwu Foods and Pies, and Yahuwu Furniture Stores, which have enjoyed tremendous community-based success and support for more than 25 years. In 2012, the African People's Socialist Party launched Black Star Industries, bringing all of the economic institutions of the party under one umbrella and creating partnerships with community members. Last year, Chairman O'Malley, as Malcolm X did more than 55 years ago, was invited to participate in formal debates at the Oxford Union. He was asked to argue in favor of the House embracing an ever closer African Union. These debates can be seen on YouTube. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. Thank you for taking the time to join us today, Chairman. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I am really excited to have you on today and to talk about a number of the issues that face the African world. And we say African world because one of the things that we like to do here at the programs, and pretty much in everything that we like to do, is we like to look at Africa as a totality. And it's important for us to look at the commonalities before we start looking at the differences. And once we understand what connects, then we could kind of sparse out and see where things kind of move into generative conversations or generative conversations with each other. And with that said, I wanted you to respond to this particular thought process. And I've been dealing with this thought process myself, particularly in my teaching and scholarship and having conversations with colleagues who are practicing in academia and outside of academia. Respond to this particular postulation that I think that is important to understand the African world today. And what that postulation says is this: is it possible to link the normalities, and I put normalities in quotes, of the world system that is rooted in the forms and functions of imperialism and colonialism, as they respond to two particular things that Europe has gifted the world, and I use gifted very tongue-in-cheek. The first one is Europe's reconceptualization of the human, that is, the perpetual processes of dehumanizing the African world as justification and maintenance for two, the idea of ownership and the creation of private property.
Well, I think that what you have done is raise the question about the dialectics of this relationship between Europe, Africa, and the rest of the world. And the fact that Europe itself came into being as a concept and as generalized territory, and we consider it a nation as a consequence of the assault on Africa in particular. This is the process that gave rise to capitalism and colonialism throughout the world. When I say the assault on Africa and then the colonization of the world is what gave definition to what we now characterize as Europe. And it also is the basis for the existing world economy, capitalist economy. Before the trade in African people, before the looting and plunder, colonial looting and plunder that brought feudal Europe into a whole new era and created an entirely different world, where there was no longer this casual relationship between different countries and places in the world, but all hooked into a single world economy that was capitalist economy. And Europe attached itself to the body of humanity as this capitalist power site. And it is from this where Europe, what we now call Europe, and the people who live in Europe, identify themselves primarily in relationship, or define themselves primarily in relationship to each other, the Celts, the Norns, the Saxons, and what have you. It was the attack assault on Africa in particular that gave rise to a whole new social system, and where these warring tribes that had came to be Europe began to define themselves primarily in relationship to us. Before that, the contradictions, the profound contradictions that what we now know as Europe functioned effectively within that body. Again, these warring tribes struggling with each other, against each other, and then the bounty of the slave trade and colonialism is what gave them a new identity that was born through the process of identifying themselves collectively in opposition to the rest of the world, and particularly in opposition to Africa. So you have a whole social system, the capitalist system, born of that process, and a whole European consciousness born of that process. And the process that that resulted in uniting this disparate, again, warring tribes at the expense of the unity of Black people, Africans, and other oppressed peoples around the world. And in fact, the last 500 years or so has been a history of imperialism. And what we see in terms of what we characterize as the crisis of imperialism today is the struggles of peoples around the world just trying to live, and as a consequence of trying to live, having to fight against this parasite crisis. This is the basis of Brexit. This is the basis of much of what we see. This is the basis even of the rise of a Donald Trump. And I say a Donald Trump, and I'm not one of those people who would assume that the what we see bad and evil happening in the world is a response to Trump. What I am saying is that he is a symptom of the overall crisis of an imperialist global social system.
There's a couple of points that I think that is important for you, if you would, to kind of unpack here, because you mentioned this idea of a European consciousness that united based upon a global economy, based upon a capitalist production, means of production and distribution of wealth and resources.
Resting on a pedestal, enslavement of Africans and the colonization of the rest of the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's important. Because one of the things that I think that you are hitting on here, and what we're talking about, is this crisis of imperialism, because the crisis of imperialism also encapsulates or calls into question this European consciousness. So if we unpack this and explore this a little bit more, is that the idea of these tribes in feudal Europe of fighting each other, there was a misunderstanding of who they were in the context of the African world, an ancient prosperous African world. Yes. And then understanding that you have, and you move that forward to a Donald Trump. Can you talk a little bit more about this European consciousness that united itself, and also its implications, particularly in the global economy today with the rise of the alt-right across the world? You have in Austria, you have in Germany, you have an attempt to reconsolidate itself, which almost be going back to almost a feudal type of system within Europe, trying to impose itself onto the global economy.
This is a really interesting kind of discussion. It's one of the few discussions that we've had an opportunity to have with anybody over a long period of time. And in fact, the first thing I think is extremely significant is the recognition that capitalism was born as a global, as a world system. It's not something that happened in Manchester, England, as a consequence of hat makers getting together and then, you know, forming guilds. And from that, you know, the superstition that's passed to us as history. Europe was rescued from its disease-ridden, impoverished status through the slave trade and through colonialism and what have you. And, you know, it changed this attack on Africa in particular, not only Africa, but specifically and particularly Africa. This attack on Africa is what, again, dragged Europe out of this whole status of feudalism. It was responsible more than anything for overturning feudalism in Europe. You know, people like to talk about, you know, these great liberal thinkers and Thoreau and others, you know, in Europe who are responsible for all these democratic ideas and what have you. But the reality is that Europe, this growth of wealth and resources coming from places that were so mysterious prior to European plunder, coming into Europe. I mean, just think of what, just from Peru alone, the amount of silver that Europe brought out of Peru damn near destroyed the Spanish economy. It was so much silver that came in there. So all this impoverished Europe is now becoming extraordinarily wealth with abundance of resources that didn't have before. And then you have this dialectic of this plunder, this coming to Europe, all these resources coming to Europe on the one hand, but it's coming from someplace else. It's coming from Africa. It's coming from what we now refer to as the Americas. It's coming from Asia, partially as a consequence of the opium war and trade and drugs and what have you. So now Europe becomes fat and prosperous, and then it affixed to the rest of us these structures that we still are fighting against, the economic structures, political structures that fix that relationship. And in the process of doing that, Europe has to explain its reality. It doesn't say, here we are as white people. This is the European definition of itself, by the way, who have so much bounty as a consequence of stealing and looting and robbing and what have you, enslaving peoples of the world. It invents itself as this more intelligent entity, more thrifty entity, this extraordinary entity that came into existence on its own. You even have the whole mythological Santa Claus, which is one of the popular means by which this parasitic economy is explained, where you know, this fat white guy lives in a place that's now he's probably vegan, but in the past he was a fat white guy, lives in a place where it's too cold actually to engage in productive labor, and has these mysterious little short creatures who create all of this stuff, and that he distributes all around the world to everybody who's good. And of course, this is something that explains the looting of the rest of the world and how Europe gets everything. It's goodness. It's a part of the process of defining Europe to itself. Europe invented itself. It created itself. And then it created us. It created the rest of us as its antipode. And so you have a political economy, and I believe this truly. I mean, Marx talked about how you have a society that, where you have a superstructure, ideas, ideology, political institutions and what have you, responsive to, given rise to by an economic basis. And if you have a European economic basis of slavery and colonialism, the whole thought process, even culture and various other manifestations that you see in Europe, popular manifestations you see in Europe, respond to that kind of reality, that everything Europe has is stolen, looted, and comes as a consequence of rape and pillage. And so you have this kind of economic base, and then you have, as a consequence of that economic base, a superstructure that explains it and explains itself to itself and explains itself to the world. And it can do that now because it's got all the guns. It controls the world economy and what have you. And almost everybody in the world drinks Coca-Cola, and everybody in the world has an explanation of reality that's furnished to us by European imperialism, and more specifically American imperialism, even though it's on a shaky foundation today.
You're raising a number of points. I know we don't have all day to talk, but there's something that I wanted you to kind of circle back around, because you talked about this development of an economic base. And you also mentioned this idea of capitalism and explaining itself, through a process of intellectualism of the period of enlightenment. Could you talk a little bit more? Because Antonio Gramsci talks about how those particular structures are actually supported by institutions that basically are built upon the myths of his existence, such as education, religion, those particular institutions that kind of basically keep lying to itself, and everybody is within that superstructure and creating these substructures in between that. Could you talk about that in the context of this idea of a working class, a black working class, in the context of a global economy?
Yeah. You know, I was imprisoned in 1966, late 1966, with one of the first active black power actions in St. Petersburg, Florida, for snatching a mural down off a wall. It's an 8-by-10-foot mural that had these caricatures. This is on the City Hall wall, had these caricatures of African people, you know, doing some obscenity. And, you know, we had struggled with the city at the time to take it down, and they refused to do it. So we snatched the mural off the wall, and I ended up, you know, with a host of charges and finally going to prison. But one of the things that we had talked about rather jokingly, that one way we could have got that mural off the wall is that if we had put on coveralls and walked into the city hall with rags at the back of our pockets and carrying ladders and platforms and simply stuck the ladders up and climbed up and then took the mural down, it would have been the most natural thing in the world, because we would have been in our place doing the work, cleaning up the joint, and we could have walked out of there with the mural. And the point that I'm making is that Europe created its idea of who we are based on the lie that it told itself about who it is. And this is one of the most important things I believe that we have going for us, because it never takes us seriously. It can take people who run around bullet mouthing and I'm going to shoot you tomorrow kind of stuff seriously, but it cannot take a genuine revolutionary movement that understands that the nature of this social system, that they hold all of capital development rests upon this fault line of colonialism and slavery. And it has built into itself the basis for its destruction. And that to the extent that we come to understand this, and what we can do is facilitate its destruction through removing this process of removing assets to the host. We deny the parasite of the host. That comes into something else that you raise in terms of certain kinds of institutions that, for example, you know, our party has created something like 52 institutions, at least, economic related institutions. We're doing this all over the world. There's no assumption that white power is going to stand around and of course, allow us to just, you know, purchase our way out of this process. This serious revolutionary struggle is going to be necessary. But I'm saying that we know what has constructed this thing. There's no mystery to us. The Marxist assumption about the development of human society going from the lower to the higher, you know, from what they refer to as primitive communism or primitive communalism through these stages and what have you. I mean, that's rather mysterious. In the real world, we know what gave birth to capitalism. And that was stealing black people. That was stealing our grandparents, our relatives and what have you, and the attack on the rest of the world that created what we now know as the Americas. So, I mean, we see the location of all of its vulnerabilities because we see that. Now, most of the Europeans, including Marx, have not had the ability to see that, because they were trapped also with a consciousness that has its origin in slavery and colonialism and this economic relationship. So they see themselves at the center of the universe. It's never been necessary for them to see the rest of the world. They've been able to pick us off over here, pick us off over there. But as we grow, our own consciousness grows, and we see the relationship of our struggle, our oppression, our exploitation as African people, of course, globally. And we see the relationship of Africa and African oppression and exploitation with the rest of the world. Then increasingly, we're able to coordinate whether we do this, you know, consciously, organizationally, and what have you. But even if we are separate places and we see activities occurring that serve the purpose of undermining this whole imperialist construct, we can participate and act in a certain way. We can develop strategies based on that. In fact, we have done that. So Europe has lied to itself, and it's lied to itself, as societies often do, to explain its reality. It cannot explain itself. It cannot explain its success. It cannot say that to itself. It can't say we have everything we've got because we enslaved people, we stole, we looted, we killed everybody. So it has to fabricate a reality for itself and for the rest of the world. It not only does it do that, not only does it convince itself of that, it has a weapon, it has sticks. It makes us say the same thing. It's the same thing that they would do in a Mississippi town where they said you looked at a white woman wrong. You have to learn how to speak to the white man so that you can't even tell, you can't tell the truth. And pretty soon you may even forget the reality as a consequence of this relationship of repression, oppression that has on you. So in the first place, Europe invents itself. And then in the process of doing that, it invents us. It creates the rest of us. We are creations of Europe in terms of how it defines us. And part of the process of our struggle is breaking free of the definition that is imposed on us by Europe. So what we have to do as a revolutionary organization, we are a revolutionary party, is take this struggle down on the ground to this working class that we've inferred up to now. Because there is a sector of the African population that has been attached to the colonial reality that we experienced, the imperial reality that we experienced, and it has a stake, a material stake, not just ideas, although obviously the ideas are really important because there's a certain kind of alienation that especially the African petty bourgeoisie and middle class has to Africa and with Africans, etc. But we have to take this science of revolution to the bottom. And that's what we do. In fact, that's what this plenary that we have coming up in February is all about. That's what we are really pushing our organization to understand more clearly, that we get out of this by organizing, not just in the United States, but there will be people here from Congo, from England, and there we can't get the people from South Africa because, you know, the United States government doesn't allow most of us to come from Africa to this country, not certainly not workers and things like that. But our objective now is to make sure that folk who are part of this organization are working on the ground, in the communities, in the prisons, in the prison wings, on the college, university campuses, and every community where the working class is located, taking this science, this understanding that we are talking about now to the masses of people, and then organizing wherever we are with the objective, of course, the major fundamental objective is the total liberation and unification of Africa and African people globally. So the working class is to be empowered because we don't have a future without the working class. And the working class has always been the backbone. I'm not romanticizing the working class. It's no romantic thing here because I recognize the kind of stuff that we do to each other as workers and what have you. But what I am saying is the workers produce all the value. The stockbrokers don't do it. The politicians don't do it. The lawyers don't do it. The preachers who usually speak for us don't do it. But the workers do, and the workers don't have anything to eat. And I say workers, I'm talking about employed and unemployed workers. I'm talking about all those people who are stuck in these barrios and ghettos and colonial entities who, if they could make a living, they'd have to do it by selling the value of their labor power. That's where the power is. And that's what it is that we are concentrating on organizing. That's one of the things that distinguishes us as a party.
Which leads me right to, because what you're talking about is very, it's this concept that is this construct of a false consciousness that is developed and yes. replicates itself. And yes. then workers separate themselves based upon these particular racialized.
But before we get to the workers, this false consciousness, a false national consciousness, where white people can sit down at a table in Berlin, Germany, and carve up Africa to give parts of it to themselves so that they don't have to fight over it as they have done in the past, and then create the Nigerian. Then Nigeria was created, as 1915, but create all these other entities, lock us into these entities, and then this is who we become. Of course, that doesn't really get consolidated until 1963. 63, was it? Yeah, the Organization of African Unity. That was part of what that process was. That's when it really gets consolidated, and the neocolonial structure was imposed on Africa by Europe again, who, to undermine Nkrumah's effort to build a really united Africa, now he's these neocolonial puppets who need.
I want to. I want to. I like to.
We are listening to a recent conversation we had with veteran activist and political theorist Omali Yashitela, chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. In 1968, Chairman Omali founded the Burning Spear newspaper and has since authored a number of pamphlets, books, and articles, including his latest book, An Uneasy Equilibrium: The African Revolution versus Parasitic Capitalism. In 1972, the African People's Socialist Party was formed, along with the Worldwide Yuhuru Movement and the African Socialist International, with branches active in the US, Europe, the Caribbean, and on the continent of Africa. From this, a number of corresponding organizations were developed. And in 2012, the African People's Socialist Party launched Black Star Industries, bringing all of the economic institutions of the party under one umbrella and creating partnerships with community members. Last year, Chairman Omali, as Malcolm did more than 55 years ago, was invited to London to participate in the formal debates at Oxford Union. He was asked to argue in favor of the House embracing an ever closer African Union. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program. Drowning in a bed
of things I see. Now he's these neocolonial puppets who need these this fractured Africa, need these this false national consciousness in order to reproduce themselves as a social force in all of these 50-some-odd different territorial entities.
And I'm glad you actually added in the national consciousness in there, because that becomes very important, because that is the mechanism that propagates these myths. So you mentioned here, and I want to just tease out, you talked about the importance of institutionalizing, right? Institutionalizing a struggle, the revolutionary struggle. But you also talked about the idea of workers globally. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of institutionalization in this particular context, but also using what the party explains or explores, this African internationalism as a framework for doing that?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. And one of the things that's always caused some distress in me is the real lack of theoretical development, theoretical work, and when it's done, you know, relatively shallow. Within the African liberation movement, we've waged struggles. I have waged struggles with various organizations and tendencies within our movement because of that. And I think that without a theory, without a worldview that says, you know, ultimately where it is that we're trying to go, then any place will end up serving, and any place will do. And And I don't think that, I think without that, again, that you don't have any potential for meaningful longevity. And one of the things that I found striking, and the things, by the way, that when we talk about some kind of historical continuity that influences us, is Marcus Garvey. Now, a lot of African intellectuals and certainly middle-class intelligentsia don't like Garvey, but I love Marcus Garvey, and our movement does. And he's done what no one else has ever done, and in terms of trying to pull together the entire African nation in a common agenda. And he was so effective that it terrified imperialists on various continents who did everything they could, of course, to destroy the Garvey movement. But part of the process of that he initiated, he called himself an African fundamentalist. And this African fundamentalist successfully made a contest with all of the other philosophical schools that prevailed at the time. I say philosophical schools, I would put Marxism in that category in terms of how it played itself out in the real world. And I would put also a variation of an expression of that, you know, came through the African Blood Brotherhood with the, you know, who was the organization that raised the Black Belt South, through whom the Communist Party was able to put forth the concept of the Black Belt South being the national homeland of African people. But this was also in a contest with Garvey, and then even Martin. What we know, the political Pan-Africanism rose as a part of a process of attacking the Garvey movement. Garvey was an African fundamentalist, and he institutionalized, he really struggled to institutionalize that, creating, trying to create an independent economy. Did something that hasn't been done since 1920, steamship lines and factories and things like that, and actually tried to establish a base on the continent of Africa itself. And he also attacked the false consciousness that African people were struggling with, trying to help us deal with that. And so that has become, that's Garvey's movement, the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Community League, is one of the things that we see some continuity there. And that was Garvey who, Nkrumah said, was the major influence in developing his worldview. Marcus Garvey read Garvey's philosophy and opinions, and that is what set him off. And that's the reason that the Black Star is in the flag of Ghana, and the Black Star football team, and the Black Star what have you. Garvey was that kind of influence. So the institutionalization in terms of philosophy, in terms of a worldview, something that fixes us, that we are tethered to. We are tethered to a worldview. And that's really important, because you see that with other manifestations of struggle in this world today, of forces who are fighting against, in some way or another, imperialism, even though ideologically they are far afield from where we would be. But I'm struck by that, and everybody has to be struck by the influence of ideological influence of Islam. The jihadists and what have you all around the world who are willing to fight and struggle every place in defense of how they interpret and define Islam struggling against the West. Africa doesn't have that. Africa is still struggling with that. And so African internationalism is our philosophy. That's our worldview. It presupposes that we are one African people forcibly dispersed around the world, and that basic driving force of our movement, whether it is in Honduras, whether it is in South Africa or Houston, Texas, the basic drive is to take back our history and to define for ourselves our relationship, and to recognize the fact that the condition of every African person on the planet Earth is responsive to the assault on Africa by Europe that captured Africa, that dispersed the rest of us, and what we took with us to Mississippi, and what we took with us to various other places around the world was that poverty, that oppression, all of that, that came with the conquest of Africa. And today, Africa, 12 million square miles of nothing but richness, value, except African people ourselves are impoverished everywhere on the planet Earth. But the fact that the French are the French, and the Americans are the Americans, and the British are the British, and the Canadians, and the Turks, and the Indians, it doesn't stop any of them from coming to loot Africa. And Africa is that, and China, of course. This is the place that every imperialist on the make understands that Africa is the place that you go to. And every imperialism, every imperialist defending itself or trying to defend itself within this crisis is also looking to be more efficient in plundering Africa. So our responsibility is to unite African people wherever we are and to take back our Africa, to contest all of those who are stealing and looting Africa and stealing our future, because Africa is the birthright of every living black person on the planet Earth. That's how we see it. That's what informs what we do, our practice and what have you. So in the process of doing that, we've created the African Socialist International. And the African Socialist International became important for a number of reasons. One, because we are convinced that the black revolution, if you will, the African revolution has run into its limitations when we try to fight for our freedom within the context of the borders that have been created for us by imperial white power, who respect no borders themselves. It respects no borders. It creates these borders and locks us in So there's not going to be another civil rights movement that's going to do something for Africans in this country. We're going to have another independence movement on the continent of Africa so that we can have the same stuff that's going on that impoverishes us, that facilitates the transfer of all the value and wealth from Africa to some European or Chinese or Turk or Indian resource. And we say, no, that won't work. The borders have to go. And the borders in Africa and the borders around the world that separate us from Africa, the borders that says that no African, most Africans cannot even cross from Africa to the United States. It's like Europe, like America and Europe don't want Africans in these territories except as slaves in chains. So Africans, working people in Africa, can't come to this country. No, despite all of the nonsense they say, I mean, we know people who spent 8 years and a year's salary to get an application to leave someplace in Africa, whether that's in South Africa, whether that's in Ghana or something else, to come to the United States and only to be told that they can't come and they don't get their money back as a consequence of doing that. So, and then, of course, you've got U.S. troops engaged right as we have this discussion in war on the continent of Africa, along with the French, who are fighting us in Mali and Chad, and the United States being there, not only with AFRICOM, but that we know of, but various other special ops forces all over. So what we do, we are building these institutions. We've institutionalized our presence in Africa through the African Socialist International, not fast enough, not seriously enough yet, because unfortunately most places where we sit down on the continent of Africa, they see us too often as some kind of NGO or some kind of money machine, because you're coming from the United States, it means you got money. But the reality is that we are building in Africa. We are building in South Africa. Most extraordinarily influential organizations that we have in several of the different provinces in South Africa today. We are in Ghana. We are in Nigeria. We are in Kenya. I have been in and out of Kenya. Some places we are not there. You know, I mean, we are there for a while, and then we lose our force, our capacity there. But South Africa is not one of those. Ghana is not one of those. We're in France. We're in England. We're in the Caribbean. We're in various places throughout the United States and what have you. And our objective is to institutionalize our presence through the African Socialist International, putting revolutionary African organization on the ground everywhere African people live, exist on the planet Earth, in order to facilitate the struggle for total liberation and unification of Africa and African people around the world. So we say African internationalism is our theory, but it is a theory of practice. We say theory that cannot be implemented, philosophy, ideology that can't be implemented is worthless. And so for us, what we do is the most important thing to validate what we think, what we say, what our strategy is, what our theory is validated by what we do. It is tested by what we do. So that's how we institutionalize our presence. And this plenary that we have coming up in February is a part of the process coming out of our 7th Congress that happened in October in St. Louis, Missouri, where an incredible transformation of entire African community is happening under the leadership of our party. Coming out of that Congress in October, we're having our plenary, which is like a mini-Congress, in St. Petersburg, Florida, where our forces are coming together. We're going to look at how successful we've been in carrying out the main resolution of the political report and all the other resolutions and mandates that came from the 7th Congress. We're going to measure them by our success and then also look at what it is that we have to do going forward. So this is an institutionalized process. Even this Congress, I mean, how many black revolutionary organizations in this country, and how many in the world that you're aware of doing like these kinds of congresses that turns the organization over to its membership for the purpose of establishing leadership and designing and establishing the program, the trajectory for the organization. That is a part of the process of institutionalizing it. And the other thing is related to that is the African People's Socialist Party was founded in 1972. The Uhuru movement is older than that because I come from the SNCC movement. So for years before that, then you have 1972, the founding of our party. And to be here and to maintain a historical continuum since that time. So we're not discovering the movement. We didn't discover the movement with the killing of Mike Brown in August of 2014 that gave rise to a whole bunch of folk out there. We've been involved in the process of completing a revolution that the United States government destroyed, and destroyed it in terms of how it made itself manifest in the United States. It destroyed it when they wounded and then captured and murdered Che Guevara in Bolivia, destroyed it when they overthrew Lumumba and butchered him, destroyed when they overthrew Nkrumah, and I'm convinced killed him later on. This is what our whole movement is recovering from, and we are part of that continuum. We're not starting anew. We recognize that we have to complete the revolutionary project that was begun way back then.
And one of the things that I think that is important, just to kind of highlight to our listeners, and one of the reasons why it is, I was very excited when the organization reached out to me, is because as a person who has been, you know, studying and attempting to develop young folk with a critical Africana consciousness, whether it is on the campuses of universities or off campuses, and that has been my work. But looking at what you guys have been doing and looking at what the movement has been doing itself, I thought it was very important to make sure that we have someone such as yourself and who represents this organization and the movement behind it come on and have a platform to be able to have a discussion in public about these ideas of how to move a world that is organized against Africa and people of African descent.
Yes.
And I think
yes.
One of the things that you said that is very important, and I insist upon this, is when you talk about the institution itself being critical of itself to reorganize itself for the advancement, now you have in this plenary, right? And that is very important because you're right. You do not see that in movements per se, and the leaders are the leaders, and they're still the leaders today.
Yes, yes. I think that's extremely important. And also, comrade, what I really think is important, too, is that unfortunately, we sometimes look at history as a single kind of uninterrupted continuum. And I've seen, and you probably have also, like posters or bumper stickers that would have Marcus Garvey or Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Obama as though they were a part of the same continuum, and they're not. And I think we have to be able of criticizing our struggle overall. We criticize ourselves as organization, but criticizing our struggle overall. And Obama is not a part of that continuum of our struggle. In fact, he is a consequence of the defeat of our struggle. Obama could not have even been elected president if Martin Luther King were alive, because King was and I say Martin Luther King. Of course, I'm not a King follower advocate. But the point is that Obama could only do that because there was no contest by black people on the ground that would say, this is what we want, this is what we demand. And Obama didn't have to speak to the black question at all. And he didn't have to say anything about black people to white people except when he ended up criticizing us. That was most of what he had to do. So he's a consequence of the defeat of the revolution. He's not a part of the continuum of the revolution. And we have to be able to critique our own struggle, our own movement, and look at what errors did we make then, and what could we have done better, and what do we have to do now that's different from what we've done in the past. And then as an organization, we have to also look at our own shortcomings and say, how did we measure up to what it is that we set out to do? Because, you can keep doing the wrong thing and doing the wrong thing. If you never critique it, then you don't have the ability to correct the contradiction. We engage in a very serious way in our party. Right now, in this thing we call criticism and self-criticism. And it's difficult for some people because they what they hear is blame and avoiding blame. And that's not what we're talking about. We're not blaming someone. We have to critique it. We criticize it so that we can fix whatever we identify and fix contradictions so that we can be better moving this revolutionary project forward. So that is a critical observation, I think.
And I agree. And before I let you go, I want to have your perspectives and thought processes on the question of the planetary crisis of the ecological degradation that has been caused by, you know, when they talk about humans causing climate change, what you're really talking about is the capitalists pillaging of the earth. Could you talk a little bit about before we kind of move on, because I don't want to keep you too long because I'm getting excited. You should see my notes here. I'm writing and writing and writing. but just to value your time, could you talk a little bit about the African world in relation to the African working class in relation to the climate that is in crisis right now?
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. And one of the criticisms I make of the people who are involved in this struggle around the climate is that somehow they would separate human beings from a part of the ecology itself. We are a part of the ecology. And how do you think that a social system that would sell human beings and degrade us. In fact, the climate has changed at different times as a consequence of the attack on Africa, the destruction of forests all over the continent. I don't have immediate access to it, but I read, a few months ago how at one juncture the climate, there was a climate change just based on the destruction in Africa of what Europeans have done there, of the various foliage and what have you on the continent of Africa, and also in instances where people were removed and cities and things like that overgrown as a consequence of that. So that's fundamental. But the thing is, it's striking, is that V.I. Lenin once said that the capitalist will sell you the rope to hang him with. And the suggestion there is that they will do anything for money, that the system itself, it can't help it. It can't stop. It wouldn't be capitalism if it could stop doing that. And so that the primary thing for the capitalist system, for the system of capitalism, is profit. And that's the driving force for everything. So if it means destroying the rainforest in Brazil or destroying sectors of the rainforest in various parts of Africa, they'll do it if it's profitable to do that, even if it means destruction of the planet itself. And that the way out of this is that we really have to recognize, as we fight and try to push back on these areas of climate change, that thing that we really have to do, what we are really struggling to win African people to do, especially Africans who are on the continent of Africa, but not just on the continent of Africa, we have to have a revolution. This social system and the people cannot coexist. It has to go. And I'm not saying that we're going to wake up one morning and wish it away or everybody's going to get armed and go ahead and do it in that fashion, but I'm saying that on our agenda, this overturning of this social system, this global capitalist predatory system, has to be at the top of our agenda so that everything that we do takes us toward that. And when we're talking about everything from climate change to the rest of that, that has to be on our agenda because there's no way short of that. And the problem is that most white leftists and many black white leftists leave out the absolute necessity to get rid of the social system if we're going to save the planet. The planet cannot coexist with the capitalist social system, and every day shows us that. And this is one of the reasons, you see, some sectors of the capitalists themselves who represent themselves like calling themselves socialists of various kinds, running for president now, because there are some thinking representatives of the capitalist class themselves can see some of the damage that's being done, and so they will raise up some questions. But the problem, of course, is that Bernie can't do it, and none of the others can do it because they are not talking about really getting rid of the capitalist system. They're talking about moderating it. And there's no way that this system can be moderated. It can't be done that except by the resistance and struggles of the peoples around the world.
And one of the points that I want to make sure that our audience get out of this conversation is that when we're talking about the ideas of someone like Marx is promoting, that was basically the center of an African ethos, a way of organizing society itself.
Yes. I think it's really important. I mean, you know, there's several things about that. One, you know, Marx makes a prediction of the destruction of capitalism, or the overthrow of capitalism, coming as a consequence of the worker, working class, the industrial working class, you know, achieving this capacity as a through the development of the capitalist system itself and the industrial capitalist system as centers. And he wrote this. And part of the time he wrote this, he was being financed and funded by his good friend Frederick Engels. And Frederick Engels' father was a capitalist. And much of his money came from textile and cotton. Cotton picked by black people in the Caribbean and what have you is what funded Marx's work on capital and other things that he did that predicted the victory of the workers. But when he said the workers, he was talking about the industrial white. He didn't say white, didn't have to say white, because that's what it meant, the industrial working class. When he had the ability at some juncture to talk about the primitive accumulation of capital, the one that thing that started it all up, turning Africa into a warring for the commercial hunting of black skins, he was able to say that. And he was able to say that capitalist production in Europe required as a pedestal, he talked about the wage slavery in Europe, he said, required as a pedestal slavery pure and simple in the New World. He was talking about the whole system resting on the backs of black people. That's what he was talking about. And at some juncture, he talked about this primitive accumulation also including China, that where England made a war, the Opium War, and there were other things like that he was able to talk about. But he could not see that we were sent to the revolutionary project because we were just things. And our significance was not unto ourselves. It was our significance was based on what it contributed to what he saw as the development of European society, as the development of the this world, which was the only world in so many ways. And it's up to us. You know, we have to define our reality. And I'm not saying this as some kind of blind cultural nationalist or something like this. I'm saying this as a scientist who understands that human beings are the ones who have a responsibility. Human societies define themselves and define for themselves, that is the leaders of those societies, what it is that they, where it is they want to go. And it's human beings who decided that there was such a thing as Europe. It was human beings. I can't remember the name of this man. This is considered the father of Italian, the father of Italy, who made the statement that we have now created Italy. Now we must create Italians. You understand? Human beings make those kinds of decisions. We have a responsibility to ourselves and to our future to decide for ourselves what the future is going to look like and to fight for it and to achieve it. And that's what we are trying to organize on the ground now, to give our people this capacity, this leadership, and a revolutionary philosophy that we are connected to that makes a prediction that we will be victorious and Africa will be ours, Africa will be united, and black people around the world will be free. And the whole different social system will come into existence as a consequence of that. One more thing related to that. You know, this is one of the conundrums that the Marxists have found themselves faced with, this whole question of socialism in one country. And Lenin was trapped with this. You know, even Bolsheviks who participated in the Russian Revolution were reluctant to take it on because they said you can't have revolution, you can't have socialism in one country. And Lenin was looking for, and he certainly can't have it in a backwards country like Russia. And Lenin was looking for Germany and others to join this revolutionary project, and it didn't happen. But with Africa, with African people being in the United States, being throughout the Americas, being throughout Europe, being on the continent of Africa, building the kind of organization that we're in the process of creating right now, gives us the ability not to talk about socialism in one country, but to talk about the whole liberation of socialism in every country, with African revolution being the determining economic factor in the world.
And as we close out, you mentioned the plenary. Could you talk a little bit more about when the plenary is, and also is there a possibility that you know, folk can either join, or they can join maybe mobile, maybe do streaming or something like that. Could you give us a little bit more information on the upcoming plenary in February?
Well, our plenary in February is from the 1st through the 3rd, and it's going to be in St. Petersburg, Florida. And we welcome people to come and to participate. And the theme of this this plenary is Vanguard Up, the unity of theory and practice. And the people can find us, can locate us for this plenary at www.APSPplenary.org. And you should go there. Go to www.APSPplenary.org, and you can register for participation. And we expect people to be here from throughout the United States, and some people will be here from Europe, and some people are trying even right now to get here from Africa. But it's going to be a really meaningful, it's going to be a tight kind of production. And as I said, it's like a mini Congress. Everybody's excited about it. We're working our butts off, and people are pissed off at each other because we're driving to, you know, to make everything perfect and for it. And we anticipate everybody coming and participating in this Congress, this plenary. And like I said, people will be here from every place, and you get a real opportunity to see what the future looks like in this process.
And thank you for this robust conversation that basically encapsulated Cedric Robinson, CLR James, Cabral, Fanon, Vico, Torre. This conversation went around the world, specifically trying to understand, and also your work on the ground is very important to the long trajectory, to the long tradition of Africana freedom movements. Thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me. And I'm really impressed with the fact that they're people who are entertaining the kinds of theoretical questions and issues that you're dealing with. And I think your students must be extremely fortunate to have access to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.
Where you came from, where I come from, you gotta do what you gotta do.